From WGCU News, this is Gulf Coast Live. The term elder abuse typically brings to mind victimization by family members or neglect on the part of nursing home staff, but a new study from Cornell University finds that hostility between residents is a growing problem in the U.S. Nearly one in five residents involved in the study had reported experiencing some form of elder-to-elder mistreatment in the previous month. We'll take a closer look at the report's findings and recommendations for identifying and addressing the problem. Plus, the holidays are a time that prompt many residents to open their hearts and wallets, and a season that sparks a lot of charitable giving. We explore how to make sure your charitable donations are really going to organizations and efforts that use your dollars responsibly, along with other ways to avoid becoming a scammer's next victim this holiday season. First, this news. This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm John Davis. Thanks for joining us. I wanted to take a moment at the beginning of today's show to acknowledge our technical glitch with the music closing last week's encore conversation on the role of evolution and creationism in the classroom. The loud music volume was a technical mistake we sincerely apologize for, and it was not an attempt to censor or suppress the perspective of our guest in that segment. You can listen back to the full segment on our website, wgcu.org/Gulf Coast Live. Coming up, the holiday season is a time when the giving spirit prompts many of us to make charitable donations. But News Press consumer watchdog columnist Tel Mel says people tend to do more homework on how they spend their money than on how they give it away. She joins us later this hour for a look at how to make sure your charitable donations are really being used the way you intended. We'll also look at other ways scammers can use the holidays to target new victims. But first, for many, abuse of elder residents in nursing homes or assisted living facilities typically brings to mind victimization by a family member or abuse and neglect caused by nursing home staff. But in a new first-of-its-kind study from Cornell University, researchers found that elder-to-elder mistreatment is a significant and growing concern in the U.S. Nearly one in five elder participants in the study reported experiencing some form of disruptive or hostile behavior involving other residents. The full results of the National Institute of Aging-funded study were made public at a Gerontological Society of America symposium last month. With about 72,000 of the nation's nearly 1.4 million nursing home residents residing in Florida, the study's implications are particularly important here in the Sunshine State. Joining me now for an in-depth look at the study's results and recommendations for addressing this growing problem is the study's lead author, Dr. Carl Pillemer. Dr. Pillemer is a professor of gerontology and medicine at the Cornell Medical College, and he's also the author of the book 30 Lessons for Living, Tried and True Advice from the Wisest Americans. Dr. Pillemer, welcome to Gulf Coast Live.
Oh, well, thanks for having me. It's great to have this opportunity to talk with you and your listeners.
And I invite our listeners to join the conversation. If an elder loved one of yours is in a long-term care facility and has experienced abuse, hostility, or other problems stemming from other residents of the facility, give us a call and tell us your story. You can connect with our guests by calling 877-GCU-TALK. That's 1-877-428-8255. Send email to gulfcoastlive@wgcu.org. You can also post comments and questions on Facebook at WGCU Public Media or join the live Twitter chat using the hashtag GulfCoastLive. And Dr. Pillemer, what prompted you and Dr. Mark Lax to conduct this study in the first place?
You know, I'd say that one of the major reasons was, as individuals who spend time professionally in nursing homes, it's something that we ourselves had seen frequently, and especially my colleague Dr. Lax, who's a medical doctor. I'm a sociologist. He does a lot of medical direction in nursing homes, and this is a continual complaint of staff who work there and sometimes of family members that even though, as you pointed out, we think of the problem of aggression and violence in nursing homes as coming from staff to residents. In fact, in their view, these kinds of resident-to-resident altercations were much more prevalent. So I'd say one part of it was just simply observing this behavior. So, for example, when I conduct research in a nursing home, I frequently see it myself. I would say also there had been some dramatic reports in the news media and from advocacy groups on the vulnerability to mistreatment by other residents, including actually some quite severe violence and homicide. So I think all those kind of anecdotal reports came together and led us to believe that this was a very fertile and important area for study.
And from what I understand, the data analyzed in the study comes largely from surveys or interviews conducted, you know, with the nursing home residents themselves. How many people did you survey in terms of the residents, and where are those nursing home residents residing?
Sure. These were 10 nursing homes in New York State, and they were a mix of urban and suburban facilities. All of them were actually rather large, 250 beds or more. And that was really done for the convenience of the study. This was an extremely time-consuming and complex data collection because, as you can imagine, this is a very difficult problem to study. A lot of residents in nursing homes, around half or more, have some kind of dementia, so it's hard for them to answer a complicated questionnaire. A lot of these events may happen quickly, and so people aren't really even aware of them. Somebody has to be watching. And this is such a common behavior in nursing homes that sometimes people even overlook it. And for that reason, we used a number of different methods. We interviewed each resident who could be interviewed with a detailed instrument about things they had experienced. So has another resident pushed you, shoved you, hit you, been verbally aggressive to you? Each staff who worked with a resident that was then interviewed to ask about each resident in the facility if they'd experienced this kind of resident-to-resident abuse. And we also looked at all the facility records, and we did direct observation. So it was a multiple method study. And in this study, we actually collected data on 2,011 residents in many units of these nursing homes. So it was an unusually comprehensive and time-consuming study.
Well, and you know, you mentioned interviewing some of the staff caretakers as well. And I wonder if that came into play in terms of looking at the study's results in regards to how staff at these facilities view the problem versus, in reality, how large it may actually be. Is there some disparity there between what you heard from residents and what you heard from their caretakers?
You know, it was actually rather common. I think that we probably, I don't have the numbers at my fingertips, I think we probably had more reports from the staff, I think. Of course, you know that you have residents who have memory problems mm-hmm. and may not be able to recall even over the past 2 weeks. Also, they may be a little nervous about this kind of admission. Staff actually were not only quite willing to report that it had occurred, but they also reported their considerable feelings of powerlessness and distress at really how difficult it is for them to prevent these incidents and to intervene. You know, you've got a situation where the vast majority of people in nursing homes have a brain disease. So they have some form of dementia, usually Alzheimer's. This leads to great disinhibition, and people are packed in very close quarters. So for staff, it's a feeling of, what do I do about this, and how do I prevent it? So honestly, they were quite honest about it as well.
Were there folks, as far as the residents are concerned, and I bring this up because you've talked about the issues related to cognitive impairment, who just simply because of the degree of their dementia, you couldn't really rely on any information they were giving you?
Yes, and that is the beauty of this study, and we worked with a group who are experts in this kind of assessment so that we were able to include comparable sorts of information, whether the resident, you know, had too much dementia to answer a question or not. So, for example, one of the things which occurred is we used something called a shift coupon. All the staff in the nursing home carried little pads, and if they saw an incident, they quickly wrote up some information about it and deposited it in a box. I know it sounds a little low-tech, and you might expect people to use handhelds, but this was an easier way to do it. We also had our own research assistants who were observing. And we had staff reports about residents. So the reason why the study is so comprehensive, and I can't go into all the detail, but is that it collected highly equivalent data, even when the resident, him or herself, was unable to provide it. And that's one reason why we have a pretty good deal of confidence in these findings.
And when we use the term elder-to-elder mistreatment, let's talk about the scope of negative interactions that we're talking about. What exactly are you looking to categorize and to document?
Sure, and let me give you something of an archetypal example. For example, a very typical case, and this is an actual one, is a resident is sitting in a wheelchair in a common area yelling. Let's call her Resident A. And Resident B walks over and tells her to be quiet. Resident A hits Resident B on the hand. A nurse comes over and separates them, but then another resident is starting to wander off and she has to leave. Resident B then kicks Resident A, and it just sort of escalates from there. So it's often a mix of verbal and physical aggression. But the types of mistreatment that we looked at were, in particular, active upsetting verbal aggression, like screaming, scaring somebody with threats, bossing them around, insulting their race or ethnic group. Then our physical actions, including hitting, kicking, grabbing, pushing, shoving, biting, and those sorts of things. And the third main area was unwanted overtures of a sexual kind, making sexual gestures, touching someone, or even, for example, crawling into bed with someone. We also had an other category, which in particular involved things like wandering into another person's room when they didn't want you in there, throwing things, or rummaging through their things. And so those were the main things. It was verbal behaviors, physical behaviors, sexual behaviors, and then a category of other behaviors.
Mm. And, you know, I think one of the key findings was that nearly 20% of residents in the study reported some form of elder-to-elder abuse that had occurred at some point in the previous 4 weeks. I mean, obviously you know that this is an issue or you wouldn't have studied it in the first place, but were you surprised to find the problem was as prevalent as you found?
I have to say we were quite surprised. We knew this was prevalent, but we didn't know how prevalent. And at a 20% rate, for your listeners who are real number crunchers, it was around 19.8% of people had been involved in one of these incidents. And to put that in context, there's no question that this is an underestimate, given that some staff and some residents might be unwilling to admit this or that we wouldn't have seen incidents. So I would consider this to be, you know, the low end of the possible estimate. So yes, we were struck by how frequent it is. And to us, it helps to explain why the response to it may not be as appropriate as one thinks it should be. If something is occurring this frequently, it's occurring daily or multiple times a day, unfortunately, in these situations, everybody can simply get used to it. Hmm. You know, you can only deal with the most egregious forms. So, we were, surprised, and it certainly calls for a very serious look at this problem, especially because these folks are frail already. So even a minor incident can sometimes lead to serious injury. So, it seems to be a reasonable public health problem that occurs in nursing homes.
Can you give us a breakdown on the prevalence of the different types of elder-to-elder mistreatment? I would imagine that, you know, things like shoving or verbal abuse would be, you know, strikingly more common than, say, mistreatment of a sexual nature.
That's correct. So around 16% of the residents had been involved in a verbal incident. Around 6% had been involved in a physical incident. A little over 1% had been involved in a sexual incident. And a reasonably large category, between 10 and 11%, had been involved in an other category, which, as I said, was often invading someone's private space. Really, these are all things, and part of our definition was things that would be perceived as unwelcome or abusive in a community setting. The idea being that we shouldn't use different standards. If you're in your house and somebody wandered into your room and you tried to get them out and they wouldn't leave, you would find that, you know, disturbing. Hmm. And the same is true in these environments. So that was part of our definition, is something that would be perceived as unwelcome, aggressive, or abusive in any setting.
We're exploring results of a new study looking at the prevalence of elder-to-elder mistreatment in long-term care facilities. We're talking with the study's lead author, Dr. Carl Pillemer of Cornell University. You can join our conversation with a phone call to 1-877-GCU-TALK. That's 877-428-8255. Join our live Twitter chat using the hashtag Gulf Coast Live, or post comments and questions on our Facebook page at WGCU Public Media. And Dr. Pillemer, in analyzing the data, did you find patterns among the perpetrators of elder-to-elder mistreatment? Is there like a profile of the elder long-term care resident that seems to be more likely to cause these kind of negative interactions?
That's a great question. And let me make one distinction, which is really important. One thing that we were not easily able to do in this study was to clearly distinguish between a victim and a perpetrator. We're actually doing analyses now to understand that more, but in so many cases, it was impossible to make a determination because, as in the example I gave, it's really an interactional situation, and by the time someone gets there, it's hard to tell really who started it, especially with dementia. So our prevalence rates are for being involved in a resident-to-resident elder abuse event. So that's one key distinction. But there really were some things which distinguished people who did get into these situations. And interestingly, it was often people who were younger. Now, clearly nobody's very young in a nursing home, but they tended to be younger. They tended to be cognitively impaired, but not severely cognitively impaired, and to have lower levels of functional impairment. So it's somebody who can get around, who's able to be mobile, who can either place themselves in harm's way or cause harm, but who has dementia. So if you're extremely demented, you often are confined to bed or to a wheelchair, and you're unable to get involved in these kinds of things. Along those lines, we also found that people who were involved in special units in the facility that catered particularly to dementia patients. These are so-called special care units for people with Alzheimer's, were much more likely to be victimized. So I think you get that portrait. But there was one finding that was unusual, and perhaps your listeners will have an idea. Individuals who are African-American, and these were in a part of the country where there were a substantial number of African-American residents in most of the facilities, were substantially less likely to be involved in these kinds of incidents. So you were more likely to be involved if you were white than you are to be if you were African-American. And the final thing I'll say, because it's very important from a policy perspective, is there was an indication, not one of the strongest findings, but still a trend, that when there were more staff to take care of the residents, these rates were lower. So having more staff on the floor who can provide more individual attention to residents also seems to help to protect against this occurring. So that seems like something which nursing homes could really work on that might help to prevent this problem to some degree.
Yeah, that item that you noted earlier about African Americans being less likely to be involved in these types of interactions than, say, Caucasian or Latino residents, I found that very curious. Is there any idea that you found in the data as to why that might be?
Well, you're right. It is an intriguing finding. We have taken it to our colleagues who specifically study minority elders and minority elders in long-term care, and we have asked them for their ideas. One possibility is that in these nursing homes, and again, I don't want to sound like we're grasping at straws because we don't quite know, so I would tell your listeners we aren't really sure about these. I'm speculating. But the majority of the staff in many of these nursing homes were also African-American. So one speculation is there might be kind of a cultural comfort or cultural matching where staff may understand each other better and where staff may be more responsive. There also is some research which colleagues alerted us to showing that older African-Americans in general tend to be more compliant in healthcare settings. There are some other possibilities. Perhaps some of the underlying factors may differ. So, for example, there are a few studies showing that pain levels are slightly lower among African Americans in the nursing home population. Either pain is better managed or people report less pain. Pain is a reason why people act aggressively in nursing homes. So we're trying to tease out those factors. But I'll be honest, it was a very strong finding, and we're still trying to figure it out.
Oh, very interesting. I'll be looking forward to what comes out of that, further study into that. And, as far as recommendations go, how can we go about better addressing this problem? Do you think it's merely an issue of providing more staff, or is there more to it? Do you think maybe as you mentioned earlier, we don't always even recognize the problem?
Right. It is a complex issue. I would say, and this is not to be pessimistic, but because of the prevalence of brain disease, the fact that people do act in ways that they never would act otherwise, so it's not a 100% preventable problem. Because there was a certain category of events that simply occur without any explanation or apparent cause. I would say even in my own work, I've walked past a resident in a nursing home who has lashed out and hit me as I was walking by. So it's not going to be possible to completely prevent this. However, staff awareness, we think, is a major part of the toolkit in dealing with this. Simply having people be aware that this is really ought not to be a normal occurrence, it ought to be intervened in, and therefore staff training around awareness is really critical. A second thing to do is to give staff ideas of what to do, and we've been working on a training program with that in mind. And third is definitely staffing. Fourth, we actually found that crowding and environmental kind of, confusion or hubbub really seemed to contribute to this. So it would seem that design decisions might work. I don't know if we're running out of time. Do I have time for one last comment?
Absolutely. Yes, we have time.
I think a thing that we need to do is to start treating this as a solvable problem. And if you talk to folks who work in nursing homes, they just tend to accept this as inevitable. And I use the example of when I was going to grade school in the early 60s. If someone had once told me or my parents that there would be anti-bullying programs for kids and that there would be zero tolerance of bullying in schools, everyone would have thought that people were out of their mind because this was considered to be a fundamental part of childhood that kids just dealt with. I think, by the same token, simply recognizing this as a problem, trying to think about what a zero violence tolerance policy would be in nursing homes, really setting our aims higher for protecting people from this. I think really that kind of a mindset, and I think it really takes an alliance of the providers and folks who work in nursing homes and unions who represent them and families and residents themselves to try to come up with some good solutions.
Dr. Pillemer, I've got to tell you, in a previous life, I worked in a healthcare setting, and the only time I ever incurred any kind of violence was with a man with Alzheimer's disease. I went to stick him with a needle, and immediately he reached out and punched me. And it wasn't until years later that I had actually had some kind of training into working with patients specifically with dementia and Alzheimer's, and I was able to look back at that incident and think, oh my gosh, I could see everything that I had done wrong leading up to that.
You are absolutely right. It's so, when someone's upset, our natural impulse is to put our hand on their shoulder. But with someone with dementia who's agitated, that may be the worst thing to do. So you're right. It really takes specialized skills to deal with somebody who's potentially aggressive.
And on that vein, do you think that could go a long way towards resolving this problem, is just providing better training for staff members who work with these patient populations?
I think it's the first thing that we need to do, because exactly as you pointed out, staff get a lot of training in how to deal with residents, but training that actually says to, say, a nursing assistant, look, when you enter this job, you have a reasonably strong chance, an almost 100% certainty, of getting hit yourself or having your hair pulled or something like that, and you are going to view it quite frequently among residents. So one thing is just to be upfront about it, that other than prisons or mental hospitals, this is one of the most high conflict and high aggression situations that people ever work in. And indeed, a workplace injury among the people who work there is very high because of these situations. Because so that, absolutely, awareness and training and giving staff tools. Here's what you do. Here are steps that you can do. Here's when you need help from a psychotherapist or from a psychiatrist or when you need help from a social worker. I think really just giving people a toolkit. We have begun to do that. We've created a six-step approach, and we're testing it now. And the initial response seems very good, that it seems to increase awareness and to help to decrease some of the behaviors. I'll say one other thing, though. This problem results in part from something extremely good. When I started working on nursing home research 25 or 30 years ago, it was very common that people were simply tied down. If someone was aggressive, they were placed in physical restraints, and they didn't have the opportunity to cause trouble for anyone else. We have very rightly almost eliminated the existence of physical restraints, and we're trying to reduce the chemical restraints. But that poses a whole set of additional problems in that people are more mobile. So it's a difficult world for staff. I think that's one of the best things we can do is understand the contingencies they work under, because it's tough for them.
Right. Well, switching gears a little bit, I was hoping you could tell us a bit about your book, 30 Lessons for Living, and about just about the process of researching and writing the book itself and what prompted you to do that.
Well, thanks. And everybody, you know, people who don't, you know, who I talk about this for the first time often find it highly surprising, because this work on that book called 30 Lessons for Living and the set of studies which created it, which are called the Cornell Legacy Project, are about as different from studies of elder abuse that you can possibly imagine. Because what that book does is it goes to some of the wisest older people in America, people from all around the country in their 70s and beyond, and many in their 80s and 90s and beyond, and asks for their advice for living. So which something really no one had ever done before on a large scale is go to older people throughout the U.S. Yeah. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I didn't say anything. I'm sorry.
Oh, sorry. Mm-hmm. Sorry. There must have been a little electronic glitch. The idea was really to find out, what do older people know about having a happy, healthy, enjoyable, and fulfilling life that younger people don't, and try to transmit that advice. Now, oddly, there is a connection to elder abuse and to the problems of older people that I would like to share, because I think it's important. When I started doing this legacy project, which really emphasizes the strengths and the wisdom of older people and what they can offer as sages for the rest of us, it really came as the result of a powerful revelation. About 10 years ago, I realized I'd spent my whole life studying the problems of old people and old people as problems. So I was working on topics like this, elder abuse and chronic pain and nursing home care and Alzheimer's disease. And I sat down one day and realized it was almost like I was rewriting the book of Job for old people. And really it occurred to me that that's how our society treats older people too, as sick and frail and even busting the federal budget now. So I really wanted to do something different, a thing that focused on older people as strengths and resources and sources of good advice. Yeah, so for 10 years now we've interviewed around 2,000 older people, asking their advice on all kinds of topics. And it's just been fascinating. And we have a new book that's coming out on January 8th called 30 Lessons for Loving, which is older people's advice on love, marriage, and relationships. And we hope that will interest young people, too. Thanks for asking.
All right, yeah. And we just got a comment on Facebook from Jane. She says, my mother's roommate stole her shawl right off her back in front of me. Is that kind of right in line with the types of incidents you'd see, even just theft?
One of the largest categories of reasons why this occurs falls in the category of roommate issues. And this is not so much a scientific opinion as an observational one. If we could give everybody their own room in nursing homes, and some places now do, and that's very common in Europe, we could solve a lot of this. It's very difficult for two people, both of whom have memory issues, to easily live together. So absolutely, that's a very common scenario. And it's not the older person's fault. It's very likely in that person's case, the other resident may have thought it was hers. Or, you know, probably didn't have the control over it. So, yeah, that is a very common scenario. Taking someone else's belongings, rummaging them through them, you know, having arguments about what belongs to who. It's very difficult. And most of these people haven't lived with a roommate, like maybe ever, except for their spouse. So, yeah, no, you're... that particular individual has really targeted one key source of this problem.
Well, that is all the time we have for this portion of the show, so we'll have to leave it there. But thank you so much, Dr. Pillemer, for joining us.
Well, thanks very much to you, too, and I hope to join you again someday.
All right. Dr. Carl Pillemer is the lead author of the Elder-to-Elder Mistreatment Study and a professor of gerontology and medicine at the Cornell Medical College. He's also author of the book 30 Lessons for Living, Tried and True Advice from the Wisest Americans. We're taking a short break, but when we return, the holidays provide a great opportunity to show generosity to family, friends, and the greater community through gift-giving and charitable donations. Unfortunately, it also creates opportunities for scammers to find their next victims. We take a closer look at how to avoid getting scammed this holiday season. That's conversations just ahead. Stay with us. You're listening to WGCU, NPR for Southwest Florida.